You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 19th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, vacation week marches on. My 8-year-old daughter on vacation from school. And you know what that means. I take a vacation so that I can tell her to pick up her room or model her rainbow loom or help her.
You can exploit that little girl's labor and sell those looms.
That's true. But now she's moved on to duct tape art.
Really?
Yes. And so
duct tape wallets are a big thing.
Yeah, she's not there yet. She's just doing bows or something. But here's the point, is that what I'm doing right now, I can almost guarantee to 100% certainty, I am simply sitting in her room chaperoning her use of a glue gun because it's too hot and it's too dangerous to do it on alone. And then I got to be there to oversee her use of an X-Acto knife. And then I've got to use my fat little fingers in an attempt to perfectly fold a piece of duct tape so that they match up and not destroy it and be subject to her wrath. So that's my vacation. But I know you folks probably aren't on vacation. Maybe some of you are. And thus, we give you all new material today. Yes, on the program today, Lauren Coodley, author of Upton Sinclair, California Socialist, Celebrity Intellectual, on Upton Sinclair. Jonathan Voss, progressive pollster, on the popularity of progressive policy, recorded at the Families USA Health Action Conference 2014. And also from that same conference, Max Richman, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. The headline from that is, if President Obama could cut your Social Security tomorrow, he would. Don't believe me? Listen to Max Richman. All right, folks, enjoy today's program. Tomorrow is a blockbuster, and particularly for members. Wait till you see what we have for you tomorrow. Don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. If you buy crap through Amazon, do it at our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Very easy. Just click on the link, buy your stuff through there. You won't notice a difference, but we will. We get a little kickback. Just coffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Enjoy today's show. Lauren Coodley, Jonathan Voss, Max Richman.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to fight to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know: the poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose.
We are back on the Majority Report. On the phone with me now is historian and author of her latest, Upton Sinclair, California Socialist and Celebrity Intellectual, Lauren Coodley. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, all right, Lauren, let's start with some aspects of, and I want to get into why you you wrote this biography on Upton Sinclair, but I want to get into that in a couple of moments. But first, I mean, let's talk about Upton Sinclair. One of the things that I find really interesting is what brought him. Of course, he is the author, we should say, of The Jungle. I think that's what most people know him from. He was author of many books, a writer. He also involved in filmmaking, which I didn't I don't know if I was fully aware of. He won at one point the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. He was a socialist, a feminist, which I learned from your book.
It's tax season. Call A&J Tax.
Oh, A&J Tax has been a proud member of the Greece community for over 35 years. Call-
he was a socialist, a feminist, which I learned from your book, an anti-communist. He actually went on to become a bit of a, I guess, I don't know, a dietitian is the right word, but and a prohibitionist, which the reasons which I didn't fully grasp until I read your book as well. But let's talk back about Upton Sinclair. The Jungle. Why did he decide or give us the context in which he started to write The Jungle?
Okay. Yeah, I love that story. You know, there were a lot of alternative magazines. We would call them, you know, alternative underground magazines in the early 20th century. And one of them was Appeal to Reason, sort of like Mother Jones. And in it, he wrote the he read the story of the unsuccessful strike of slaughterhouse workers in 1903-1904 in Chicago. As a socialist and as a trade union sympathizer, he was deeply grieved by their defeat. Appeal to Reason suggested that he go there, go to Chicago, live among the workers, and write a kind of expose of their lives. And they offered him, you know, like $500 to go do this. So he went to Chicago for 6 weeks. I don't think he'd ever been there. He only stayed, you know, as I said, the 6 weeks. He lived in the workers' houses. He went, we would call it undercover reporting, investigative reporting, and when he was done, he wrote what he hoped would be the Uncle Tom's Cabin of Wage Slavery. That's what Jack London said it was, said he was trying to do, and felt that he did do. The goal was to really make people feel horrible about the conditions of the immigrant workers. Of course, as you know, what most people were most concerned about was the product that the workers were making, the meat. And so he, you know, his famous comment on the whole thing was, "I aim for their hearts, but I hit their stomach."
And you know, and of course, I mean, I think most people know that as a, in many respects, as a result of what was revealed in The Jungle, Teddy Roosevelt established, you know, I guess the precursor to the FDA in terms of assuring some measure of food safety. How did he manage to? I mean, how did he manage to have that type of access? Was there, did he actually go into the, I mean, he must have gone into the slaughterhouse. I mean, was, under what auspices did he do that? Or was there just like no sense that this type of muckraking would take place? I mean, how did that happen?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Sam. You know, I know he took a lunch pail. I think he just went in like he was a, you know, a relative. I don't think they probably had a list of all the employees at that time. I don't think it was that organized. Of course, there was no union. He just showed up, you know. And what is even more perhaps surprising is that in 1914, he succeeded in getting a movie made that shows that, you know, the situation in the slaughterhouse, that replicates everything that he saw, and was one of the, you know, the great original silent pictures He himself starred in it. He played Eugene Debs, the socialist organizer. So where is this movie, you might ask?
Yes.
It disappeared, and it reappeared and was given to me during the course of my research.
Oh, that's
It's now at UCLA.
Oh, wow. And is it, can we watch it online?
I don't know about online, but you could contact the UCLA film, you know, curators, and I don't know in what way they're making it available to the public, but I felt that, you know, once I got it, I you know, owed it to have it in an archive. It was given to me by somebody that worked for Upton Sinclair. His father worked for Upton Sinclair during the campaign in California, and they used to tour around in a bus and show the movie.
Wow, that's fascinating. I want to talk about that campaign, but let's talk a little bit more. I mean, was he disappointed in sort of that he that there was that it didn't necessarily address the issue of wages, or at least it wasn't received as addressing the issue of wages?
Well, I think he felt the irony of the situation. I mean, he just plunged forward. His next project, as readers of my book will see, was to try to expose child labor. I mean, he was an activist, so he, like many of us, just went on to the next fight.
Interesting. And so that's in 1906, and so he begins to write more about this. At what point does he decide to run for governor of California?
At least 20 years later, but I'd like to say what he did immediately after the jungle, if I may.
Please.
He established a utopian colony, in other words, a commune, a place for people to live, and the entire logistical framework for it was based on a feminist theorist, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who argued that being alone with children was going to drive couples crazy and that they needed to live communally and help watch each other's children.
Well, I don't find a tremendous amount to argue with that. Before we get to the run for governor, then let's stop and talk about Upton Sinclair as a feminist. I mean, would he have identified as that? I mean, did we even have that term at that time?
You know, in 1927, his friend Floyd Dell wrote a biography of him and called him a feminist.
And
when he was 45 in 1927.
Interesting. And
yeah, you remember the people that worked for suffrage called themselves feminists.
And so, was that atypical? I mean, where, you know, place that in context for us from a historical standpoint of where.
Well, I think a lot of the men who were radicals, let's call it in the New York progressive movement of the early 20th century, many of them also identified as feminists. That is, they were sympathetic to the equal rights struggles of women, the suffrage struggles, in some cases the prohibitionist struggles or temperance movement. You know, they couldn't help but see the inequality of women, and so, you know, they were activists on many, many fronts. Remember, there were women like Jane Addams, you know, pushing the envelope, Helen Keller. All of these were friends and correspondents of Upton Sinclair.
And how did he come to, I mean, he seems to have been in the middle of a lot of different, I mean, you know, major historical figures that we reference today. How did he find himself? I mean, he would hang with Albert Einstein, with Irving Thalberg. He had a friendship with Henry Ford, which sort of strikes me as surprising, I guess, in some respects. Of course, you mentioned Jack London. I mean, how did he come to find himself in these circles?
Yeah, like know everybody. I think that, you know, that's why celebrity, I think, is in the title of my book, although it wasn't the title I chose, but the publisher wanted to put it there, and perhaps correctly, because he became a huge celebrity after The Jungle was written. And, you know, he used his celebrity to draw attention to various political issues. He used it very consciously. He invented the idea of corporate picketing. When the Ludlow massacre happened in Colorado, he said, instead of, you know, picketing the mine, let's go picket the corporate headquarters in New York. So, you know, people were drawn to him because he was very creative. He was writing plays, you know, he was writing film scripts and getting his films made. So he did have a lot of, you know, famous friends. Charlie Chaplin was a very close friend, and as well as the other people you've mentioned. You know, what I was struck by is that because he tried really hard to figure out how to live a long and healthy life and a sober life, he was able to be friends with a lot of women in a way that many male writers have stumbled upon, you know, have not found easy, let's say.
Well, from a historical perspective, why does a sober life mean that he was necessarily friends with a lot of women?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there's two ways to answer it. One is that he was deeply committed to the temperance movement because he was a child of an alcoholic. He, you know, really felt that it was a political struggle to end alcoholism and to, you know, improve the lives of women and children. You know, the temperance movement was about improving the lives of women and children. His mother was an ardent, you know, temperance advocate. You know, they got kicked out of boarding house after boarding house because, you know, his father drank up, you know, his wages. He sold whiskey. His father was a whiskey salesman. So Sinclair was, brought up to hate liquor and to see it as a very, very negative thing in his life and in other people's lives, much like, you know, other children of alcoholics or children of drug addicts. So I think it's easy to understand his temperance. Why that made him a man that women could trust and count on? Well, you know, he wrote a book called Cup of Fury in the 50s, and it's about the effect of alcoholism on all so many of his close friends who had died young, who had had, you know, their genius kind of cut short, who had struggled with alcoholism. You know, and these included Eugene Debs and Eugene O'Neill. And, you know, he went on and named names of people who had not been able to go, you know, the last mile because of their struggles with drinking.
Interesting.
So, you know, my argument is because he chose monogamy and a sober lifestyle and an interest, you know, including an interest in diet and health, he was just able to live, have a life that in which he was very trustworthy. You know, he always extended himself. He didn't just make promises. He always did what he said he would do. You know, he wrote a lot of letters to help Edith Summers Kelly get her book Weeds published and then translated. And, you know, Weeds is like a classic of, proletarian feminism. It's the only book she ever wrote, but it's about, you know, how difficult it was for her to be a mother and a housewife on a California farm in the 20s and 30s.
And in many respects, I mean, he was attacked by the right in this country for being, I guess, so, I don't know, feminized. Maybe that's that's more of a, I don't know. Was that a is that too modern of a word? I guess maybe I've been just hearing.
I've called him an early girly man. That's, you know, ever since Schwarzenegger, savaged the California legislature as being a bunch of girly men. You know, I've been fascinated, you know, with that way that that gets, you know, thrown at, men, progressive men who don't seem, you know, sufficiently masculine. Recently, you know, on Fox, they were praising Chris Christie for being a real manly man.
I think right.
You're familiar with that. So that trope has been, was used against Upton Sinclair, I'm sure against other men, but oddly, it hasn't really been critiqued very much. I mean, even some of his more contemporary biographers like to kind of make fun of him as a prize prude, as a, you know, sanctimonious man who has no sense of humor, that kind of thing.
Interesting. And so let's jump forward to his run for governor in California. What spurred that on? And is that the time where he decided to I don't know if he fully renounced being a socialist, but to at least register as a Democrat?
Yes. I don't think he renounced the Socialist Party, but he changed his registration to Democratic. I think the Socialist Party was really in a, you know, pretty much of an ebb by 1934. It wasn't as popular, as effective. It didn't have as much hope as it had in the early 20th century. So he registered as a Democrat. I always kind of see him as the, you know, the Howard Dean of California politics. He was, you know, had a very grassroots campaign, huge amount of popular culture involved. You know, there were rodeos, there were parachutists, there was parades, there were sewing bees, there were song fests, there were quilts. It was a transformative campaign in California history. It's what ushered in the Democratic Party into California. They had never been in charge before. And yes, he lost, but 2 years later, the Democrats took legislative prominence and the governorship.
And he named that campaign the Epic Campaign to Fight Poverty. I mean, did poverty, like, at that point become an agenda item in California? What came of that?
He was trying to lay the ground for the New Deal. Most of his ideas were picked up by the New Deal. He was proposing a slightly more radical version of what Franklin Roosevelt actually did. He was basically proposing that, you know, land that was fallow be given to farmers, studios that were closed be given to actors, factories that were boarded up be, you know, filled with workers. He was proposing a massive government investment in creating jobs, and as he called it, production for use, not production for profit.
And do you have a sense of like, I mean, just how much that influenced what was going on nationally, or was that influence outsized, or was it you know, part of like a larger sort of thing that was happening in the country at the time?
I think it was part of a larger thing. He met with Franklin, and, you know, listed his ideas, and he said Franklin ticked them off on his fingers and said yes, 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 yes. And he became, you know, after that, he was a big supporter of Roosevelt, continued as a Democrat for the rest of his life, very happy with the direction that the country went, and very, very devastated by Roosevelt's death. But I know I'm jumping ahead.
Well, I mean, so what did he do after the campaign? I mean, that was his sort of final foray into electoral politics, yes?
Yeah. One of the things that I don't think anybody's written enough about is the children's book that he wrote right after the campaign, when he made his first trip to Northern California and saw the Redwoods. He wrote a book called The No-Mobile, which Walt Disney made into a film in the mid-60s. But the book was published in 1936, and I think it was one of the earliest ecological children's books ever written. So that, I think, is fascinating. But after that, he wrote the Lanny Budd series, which was an 11-volume series. I call it the first anti-fascist spy novel. It was, you know, specifically, its goal was to arouse America out of its isolationism and be willing to enter the war against fascism.
I mean, he in many respects, I mean, and this is where I want to start to talk about a little bit why you decided to write this book. I mean, I know one of the things is that you see his life as one as in many respects, he was an activist who did these other things or used these other things, whether it was writing a children's book or making films, or as an extension of his activism.
Yeah, I was trying to think of who, you know, today is like him. I've had various ideas of who's like him, but my daughter suggested David Simon, the writer of The Wire. And I thought that was an interesting comparison. Someone who has a certain social analysis and uses popular culture to express it.
Interesting. I mean, give me a sense of just how he's been seen that way, I mean, by other writers, or not been seen that way.
I think he has been not thought about or studied enough because he doesn't fit easily into an academic discipline. He really doesn't belong in the English department. He didn't see his impact primarily in terms of, you know, being a writer. He saw his impact in terms of things like helping found the Southern California chapter of the ACLU. That was one of the things he wrote about as his, you know, one of his great achievements. So he was a social activist who used writing, you know, to try to move the country forward, and he really was interested in, you know, the common man and woman, speaking to them, explaining things, and he had an understanding of both poor and rich people, having grown up, you know, in both worlds. So I think he felt like he had a unique voice and a way of communicating with the average American.
Yeah, I mean, talk about that, because he did have he was exposed to both, you know, both that poverty and wealth. I mean, briefly just talk about that.
Yeah, well, he, as I said, his father was an alcoholic. They never had any other children. They all lived in one room, boarding houses. They never owned a home. But his mother came from a, you know, southern railroad family, and so when they would get kicked out of the boarding house, they would go stay with their relatives in Maryland, in Baltimore, who were pretty affluent, and he'd hear and watch, you know, their lives. And, you know, make mental notes. And, you know, the biggest question in his life growing up is, why is there, you know, poverty and wealth? Why are there such disparities in poverty and wealth? Why? And he looked to poets to explain it, and eventually he stumbled on socialism and felt that that really helped him understand the conditions of his childhood.
Interesting. And in some respects, I mean, give me a sense of what you think his assessment of his work and where we were as a society. He passed, I guess it was in 68. Give me a sense of just how he would have perceived where we were as a society. And I guess maybe contrast that with where you think he would think we were today.
Yeah, well, he was thrilled with the Great Society, you know, going through Johnson's programs. He backed 100%. And interestingly, he even supported the Vietnam War at the end of his life, because it was a Democratic president, and it was the AFL-CIO position, and he was a, you know, trade unionist to the heart, you know, all the way. So he didn't sense the criticism of Vietnam that, you know, younger people had. He, you know, would be very, very, very shocked by the food safety. You know, they're about to turn the inspection of the chicken poultry factory, you know, back to the companies themselves. The federal inspectors are going away at chicken plants, processing plants, as we speak. Civil liberties, I don't even need to tell you where we are with those. The rights of unions to organize are probably more threatened than any time since early 20th, or probably since the 30s, at least. So I think he would be really surprised, as we all are, that so many of the things we thought had been accomplished are, you know, being rolled back to the extent that the Republican Party is able to roll them back.
And I mean, just give me a sense of also of what, I mean, what you think, you know, why he's a model, you know, that, I mean, I know that was part of the reason why you decided to write this book. I mean, talk a little bit more about all the reasons that were involved in it, because it's, you know, why write a book about Upton Sinclair now?
You know, there is no Sinclair Journal. There's no Sinclair Society. There's no Sinclair Home. There is no Sinclair Studies. There's only one other living biographer of Upton Sinclair. You know, he is surprisingly unstudied. He really is in some sort of nether world where perhaps second string well-known people, a twilight world. You know, Harriet Beecher Stowe, there's a house for her that people can visit and, you know, continue to think about her impact. I, of course, firmly believe there should be an Upton Sinclair Home so that his life can be studied and understood by future generations. Where I live, there's a beautiful, you know, Jack London Park, but of course there's nothing for Upton Sinclair. And it should be in either Los Angeles or Baltimore. Baltimore, where he was born, Los Angeles.
Why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think it is? I mean, you know, here's a guy who at the very least, you know, and it is at the very least, changed at least the government's role. I mean, he thought that the government should basically nationalize slaughterhouses, didn't he? I mean,
yes.
Talk about that a little bit. I mean, he's had this sort of outsized impact, you know, going forward in terms of the government's role in terms of food safety, at the very least. But he's in some ways he's ignored. What? Why do you think that is?
You know, I've thought about it a lot. I mean, I've been working on him for 20 years, hoping to write this biography and get it published and start to change the narrative about Upton Sinclair. Why I think he's been, you know, forgotten, some of it has to do with these writers, their heirs decide to make a national historic site out of their homes. I think that's the way it works. If you're wealthy when you die, your heirs then turn the home into like a public trust.
Mm-hmm.
So Upton Sinclair's home in Monrovia, I have a, you know, an interview from the mid-60s saying that he planned to give it to the UAW and have it be a study center for activists and social justice. However, was not done, and I haven't been able to find out why not. He must have willed it to his son. His son must have sold it, and that was that. I mean, once the house is gone, it's really hard to go back there. And then, you know, there has to be a foundation that tries to buy the house, and it's a long, long process once the house goes out into private ownership.
Interesting.
That's the best I can explain it.
Well, and so just the takeaway, just again, why is it important for folks today to pick up your book and get a better sense of who Upton Sinclair was?
Well, I think that activists today particularly need some sense of how you might structure a life around activism, how you might lead a productive, healthy, and happy life, in which you're effective on all kinds of levels, both political and artistic. I think, you know, his life offers a great deal to learn from and be inspired by. As a woman activist myself, I found it very moving the extent to which he encouraged and mentored, you know, all the radical women of the 20th century. I've included a bibliography of those women at the end of my book for people who just haven't studied the incredible women activists of the 20th century. You get introduced to them through their letters to Upton Sinclair in my book.
Wow. All right. Well, it's great stuff. And finally, the Gnome-mobile, which I had never heard of until I had saw it mentioned in your work. What is that something that my daughter is going to enjoy, or is it a couple
Absolutely.
Years away?
Absolutely. I couldn't recommend it more. Walter Brennan plays a crusty old grandpa who gets converted to wanting to save the Redwoods by his darling little children, who are the kids from Mary Poppins.
Fantastic.
Very, very charming movie. Songs, elves, Redwoods, available.
Sold.
You can get it.
All right. Well, Lauren Kudle, the book is Upton Sinclair, California Socialist, Celebrity Intellectual. We'll put a link to it, of course, at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for everything you do, Sam.
Continuing our coverage at Families USA Health Action 2014, joining me now is Jonathan Voss. He's a senior analyst with the Lake Research Partners, which is a progressive polling firm. Let's talk about welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I know you guys have done a lot of work on broad attitudes of poverty, of issues of social mobility, the social safety net. Am I imagining this, or is it, at the very least, maybe they're just louder, but there seems to have been just an uptick in the demonization of the poor in this country over the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. Really, I mean, really, I guess, coming out of the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, and maybe it started when that moron sat on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and said, you know, do we want to pay for these mortgages of these poor people or whatever it is?
I would argue, actually, that it's been happening a little bit longer. We've done a lot of focus groups over the past couple of years, and there's two things that have that I think are resulting in that uptick that you've seen. First, interesting focus groups among white independent men. I had a group in Charlotte, North Carolina, and a group in Manchester, New Hampshire. And when we start talking about whether it be unemployment insurance, SNAP assistance, formerly known as food stamps or Medicaid, you hear the same. I was online at a grocery store, and the person in front of me bought their food with food stamps and then went out into their Cadillac. So there's this myth of the welfare queen that has persisted since the 80s when Reagan included that in one of his speeches.
And these guys tell you this like in focus groups?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is the same story. And I don't necessarily want to accuse them of making something up, but when they both all say Cadillac, very specifically, it is a reference to that speech about that woman on the north side of Chicago. But I think the other thing that has happened, so I'd make the point that that has been part of the conservative rhetoric for decades now. But the other thing that has happened is during the economic downturn, programs such as food stamps or SNAP assistance or TANF or unemployment insurance, those are obviously geared towards people on the lower end of the economic ladder. And middle-class families were struggling. And a lot of them said, well, what about me? I'm all for programs to help people because I care about people, but what about my help? I'm working a job. I'm trying to put my kid through college. I'm trying to put food on the table. And a decision in Washington, or the lack thereof, or the irresponsibility of Wall Street, or uprisings abroad, and all of a sudden that shit rattles the market, and now I'm out of a job, or I'm reduced hours, or I lost my health insurance. And so there was a lot of middle-class families and working-class families who saw their own lot in life and saw their own stability completely rattled. And so there was a little bit of a reaction to all these programs for lower-income folks. Well, what about me? I'm struggling too. And so I don't necessarily know if it's demonization of the poor so much as it is a recognition that a lot more people were struggling over the past couple of years than we generally like to talk about.
Interesting. And, yeah, I mean, we've had stagnant wages for the middle class now for 30-some-odd years, even coming out of this financial disaster. It was more of the same as the income inequality sort of widens. But not to get too hung up on this whole Cadillac thing. But do you ever ask them what the color of the car was?
I have not.
Do you try and see like if they're just lying?
It's my job to kind of let people continue to talk, and I kind of make a mental note of it. And I've actually gone back and looked at transcripts and pulled the quotes because it is interesting to me to hear the same story in different towns. But I think a lot of it's racially coded. They talk about it.
Right. I mean, that's the underlying
Escalade having large rims and whatnot. But I think it's kind of safe language to kind of promote necessarily I don't want to necessarily accuse someone of being racist, but there are certainly racially coded feelings being embedded in that kind of talk.
And to a large extent, I mean, isn't that sort of the subtext of a lot of this? Is just sort of that I am a struggling middle class family, and it's true that we have done nothing for the middle class, and structurally we have created all sorts of dynamics where we are picking winners and losers, and those winners always tend to be from the corporate or wealthy class in this country. But isn't there also always a racial or, anti-immigrant or some type of bias, some otherization that's happening here, so that there's always someone lower on the totem pole and they're somehow getting benefits?
I don't want to overplay that. I think that certainly does exist. I don't necessarily think it is the overlying dynamic. I think for too many Americans who have been struggling, they haven't been in a position to have government really help them. And certainly I think that the nature of what needs to happen is changing. So, for example, in 1980, 18% of all births were born to single parents, single mothers. Today, that's 40%. And so the nature of families and therefore the policies that need to change in order to address what is the more modern American family are changing. And so I think that I would like to think that in a world where there were government policies that helped, whether it be increased paid sick days or child care provided by employers or whatnot, all these different things that without those, these families are resulting in these shocks. You know, someone, their child is sick, they have to take care of their sick child, they lose their job because they missed a shift
right.
at the last minute. And so the nature of family is changing, and I think policies need to respond to that. But I think that a lot of the kind of negative attitudes towards a lot of social policies out there, there certainly is some of that racial component to it. There certainly is some of that it's going towards, if you want to put lower people on the totem pole, whether it be immigrants or lower income folk. But I think it's also because people haven't necessarily experienced or haven't seen government work for them directly. I mean, we talk about roads, we talk about education, but and we talk about nutrition labels on boxes, but the actual interface with government isn't as palatable or isn't as strong and a resonant force for middle-income families. And I think part of that needs to change with different policies that need to address a different dynamic that's going on today.
So it's not just a question of awareness. It's actually a reorientation from a policy standpoint.
I would think that's a little bit of both, yeah.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, I had a recently... I was talking to a friend who was eligible for subsidies in the Affordable Care Act, and their father, who by all accounts is a fairly liberal person, was like, "You're not going to take that government handout." And I was like, "That guy certainly takes a government handout in the form of a mortgage interest deduction on his house, or you know, presumably." Capital gains taxes versus paying regular taxes. It seems to me that there's probably a broad lack of awareness of how much the government does for everybody across the board.
I think there is a lack of awareness, but I also think that there's been a concerted effort by the right for decades now to attack government as the problem,
right?
As wasting taxpayer dollars, and it's a very salient argument that has garnered a lot of support for them and resulted in electoral gains. And I think that it is a challenge, or has been a challenge, and I think the progressive side is doing a better job of this and still has a long ways to go to proactively argue the case for why government matters. What government can do, the types of problems that we have, the link between education and success, and the importance of public education. There's a whole. I mean, I'd like to think that we know what the solutions to our problems are, but it's a difficult environment to push for those when you have a slice of the electorate that is convinced that anything that government touches its hands on is bad, is a
right.
waste of money, and is going to fail.
Are you? I don't know if you work with. With politicians at all, I presume you do some. I mean, are you seeing more? What's the trend you're seeing in terms of the politicians, in terms of on your business side? People are coming to you and using your numbers, or I mean, is there been a change in the at least in the Democratic caucus in any way that you can notice in terms of the appetite for these type of sort of progressive leaning messages?
Well, I think there's certainly some evidence. I know plenty of ink has been spilled talking about. De Blasio, for example,
right.
being in New York and the emergence of Elizabeth Warren as a powerful voice on the left. I think that there is a renewed focus, and part of this is due to the fact that we've elected folks in both parties a little further out. We've lost some of the moderates out there, so some of the voices in Washington are, you know, very strong on a lot of progressive policies, whether it be extending. And I don't think extending unemployment insurance is that progressive of a policy. I think it's good stimulus. Every penny of unemployment insurance goes directly into the economy. It's good policy.
Right.
I don't think that raising the minimum wage is that progressive of a policy. It's 60-70% of people support that.
Expanding Social Security, though.
Expanding Social Security, you actually see strong majorities across party lines supporting that. The one policy that we've seen support of consistently for years across party lines is raising the cap on wages. People don't know that that cap exists. They think of it
right.
as a loophole. And so I think I don't necessarily think that some of what are considerably thought of as progressive policies, when you look at the raw numbers of where support comes, they do really come.
Oh,
from
yeah. No, I mean,
lines.
I think it's a different scale depending on if you're talking about lawmakers and the
right.
American public, for that
right.
matter. I was just curious, are you seeing any, you know, I'm seeing the writing about the Elizabeth Warren Democrats and this
mm-hmm.
and that and, you know, the ascendancy of that wing of the party versus the third way, but are you seeing it in terms of the appetite of people coming looking for data for you on the?
It varies. I think we have foundational clients, nonprofit clients, unions, people running for office, people running to continue to stay in office, and it differs. You know, someone running for Congress in an R+4 district is not necessarily going to be as progressive as someone who's running in Brooklyn.
Right.
So it really depends on the type of person who comes to us. But certainly we are a progressive firm. We support progressive candidates. So more often than not, the people that we work for are progressive and kind of do embody that resurgent left that is more pronounced these days. Yes.
Jonathan Voss, senior analyst from the Lake Research Partners. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, continuing our coverage at Families USA Health Action 2014 in Washington, D.C. With me now is Max Richmond. He is the executive director of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I was here this time last year, mid-January in 2013, and at that time there was a serious conversation going on in Washington. Certainly, and the administration was about to, if they hadn't already, put it in their budget to cut Social Security via the chained the CPI. There was also talk of raising the Medicare eligibility age. It's been that's all seems to have changed.
Well, there's not much talk about raising the Medicare eligibility age from any quarter. There's still, a lot of interest in the White House with the idea of cutting Social Security by using a different formula to determine what the cost of living adjustment annually should be. Now, I just got an email that the president's budget will be formally submitted March 4th. So in the last budget, chain CPI was in there. It would save about $128 billion, which is real money, even these days. And that money is money that would not be in beneficiaries' pockets. We'll see if it's in the president's budget or not. We had a meeting with in the White House in the Roosevelt Room yesterday with Gene Sperling and some other key White House administration staff, and I had signed a letter to the president. And I gave it to Gene Sperling, urging him to drop the idea. I have heard from so many members of Congress that try to allay my fears about the chain CPI, saying, "Don't worry. It'll never happen, because the only way it would happen is if Republicans came to the table with a serious offer to bring revenues back in."
Right, and we can include, and people should be clear that revenues aren't simply the question of tax increases, but also it could mean closing loopholes, which we all know open up really easy once they're closed subsequently. So basically, the White House still wants to do it. Members of Congress are telling you, don't worry, there's a poison pill here that would prevent the Republicans from doing it. And everybody's just betting that hopefully the Republicans will be crazy enough to basically protect the Democrats from shooting themselves in the foot.
Isn't that sad?
It is sad
that we have to, at this point, rely on Republican intransigence to a deal that includes some revenue to protect Social Security.
Right, which would be politically disastrous for Democrats, and also from a policy standpoint, equally disastrous at a time where we've seen such failure with 401ks.
Well, exactly. And in the letter we gave to Gene Sperling for the address to the president, we made exactly that point, that we support the president's apparent position that he's going to be taking in the State of the Union, addressing income inequality in this country and the disparities and the growing disparities. And then we say in the letter, we agree with you on that, but cutting Social Security does not fit with addressing income disparity, because
it's
going to make it
inconsistent. Yeah, right.
It'll make it worse. Having Medicare beneficiaries pay more out of their pockets for certain care, for nursing home care, for home care, which is I think will be in the budget, does not fit with dealing with income disparity. So, you know, I don't know where they're probably pretty far along with the State of the Union since it's. In 5 days?
Right.
But I'm hoping someone will pay attention to what we've said.
Well, let me ask you this. From your perception, you're sitting with Gene Sperling. What is the motivation here? I mean, surely they must know what Social Security does in terms of fighting poverty. They must know if they are genuinely interested in this idea of diminishing income inequality, that cutting Social Security benefits would definitely increase income inequality. They must know that if it's a question of strengthening Social Security, there is, at the least they could do is raise the cap to the point where it is capturing the typical amount of income it's captured in the past. It's now about 9-8 percentage points
exactly.
Less than it has been in the past.
Yeah. Used or to they be 91%, now it's about 81%, 82%.
Or they could simply raise the cap. So what is it? Give me your sense of what their motive is. Why do they want to do this?
You know, I cannot understand it.
Is it politics? I mean, is it simply legacy time?
I don't know if it's it's bad politics for one thing. I mean, if you want Democrats to have any chance of being in a majority to work to support a second term agenda or the last 2 years of a second term, it's bad politics because Social Security supporting Social Security is a winning issue for Democrats. And as for policy, it's bad policy. So, you know, as I said, I cannot get into their heads. But maybe it's, Nixon goes to China kind of fixation that a Democrat will reach out and do this. I don't know. But it doesn't make sense on a policy level. It doesn't make sense politically.
It doesn't make sense politically if you assume that they think it's in their best interest to have democratically controlled Senate and House,
right.
And if everybody has written off the House, that they think it's in their best interest to have a democratically controlled Senate.
Well, it's obviously in their best interest. I mean, if they don't have...
Is it, though?
Oh, well...
I mean, let me ask you this.
I think if
here's
if,
my contention.
If the majority leader were Senator McConnell, I think... first of all, you would get with the change in the filibuster rule, you're not going to get any of your nominees confirmed for anything, and now I think the Supreme Court may say fairly soon that recess appointments, the way the
right.
White House has looked at them, are not valid. So I think it's definitely if you care about it, pushing through an agenda, I think it's bad.
If you had a sense that there is really no opportunity for you to push through an agenda because you won't get the House back.
If you were fatalistic about it, it didn't matter.
If you were fatalistic about it and you wanted to worry about your legacy, I mean, and you were to look back to the last Democratic administration, who is now considered a very popular president. He was very popular when he left, and it was because he had a Republican House and Senate that was beating up on him in many respects. He pushed through a welfare reform, which really has turned out to be somewhat disastrous in light of when you're in a situation where you're in a recession, where there's no jobs. It's caused a lot of people to go on food stamps because the state's the only way they can provide any services or any support for them. If you were looking back to that model and It's very rare to hear people criticize welfare reform of 96. Could they be looking at that and saying, this is the model for success? We cut Social Security as a Democratic administration. We do the responsible thing, the tough choices. We cut the benefits of old people. And people are going to look at this administration as one that forged some type of bipartisan movement on entitlement reform, which has never been done before.
Well, I don't know. I think you're dreaming there. I don't see that as being some a legacy that that any Democrat would be proud of. But like I said, I'm not. I can't get inside the heads of the people that are advising the president. But to me, it doesn't. As I said, to me, it doesn't make any sense politically, just the way we talked about it, or as a policy matter.
So what's your...
I think most Democrats are going to have a... I think the Democrats that I know and have worked with in the House are not eager to take on the issue of cutting Social Security. I don't hear too many of them talk... A few, and most of those are retiring.
Uh-huh.
But I think the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee would like to make hay on Social Security, Medicare, and related senior issues. They're going to have a hard time doing it if it's the White House. You know, if there's no chain CPI, but the only person that's written down the words in a budget document is the president, it's a Democratic position.
That's right. And so the president, by doing this, he must know he's handicapping. He's handicapping Democratic House members in their reelection, potential House candidates. He's handicapping just about the vast majority of Democratic Senate members, too. Maybe there's a couple.
Yeah.
Where, you know, entitlement reform would be to their benefit, at least. But he must know this. There's no way, right? I mean,
you would think so.
If I'm sitting in the basement of a hotel and I'm able to see this, surely the president can see this.
Yeah, maybe you should. Maybe you should be advising him.
Well, if he's listening, I hope he takes both of our advice. Max Richmond, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me to the program.